Welcome to Touchstone, your weekly poetry space. I'm CJ, and today I'd like to read you 10 Australian poems. They're in chronological order based on the year of the birth of each of the poets chosen, from 1864 to 1925. So these are not modern Australian poets. They are quite iconic Australian poets in their own right, however. In a later podcast, I will read you some of the work of more modern Australian poets, people like Les Murray and Bruce Dawe. I'm starting with Banjo Paterson's iconic ballad, The Man from Snowy River, and I'm planning to read the poems without commentary. So if you'd like to know a little about the poets featured in this podcast, you can go to my website, https://www.shezcj.au, where you'll find something about each of our wonderful wordsmiths. And feel free to write a comment on my contacts page. The Man from Snowy River by Andrew Barton Paterson. There was movement at the station, for the word had passed around that the colt from Old Regret had got away and had joined the wild bush horses. He was worth £1,000, so all the cracks had gathered to the fray. All the tried and noted riders from the stations near and far had mustered at the homestead overnight, for the bushmen love hard riding where the wild bush horses are, and the stock horse snuffs the battle with delight. There was Harrison, who made his pile when Pardon won the cup, the old man with his hair as white as snow. But few could ride beside him when his blood was fairly up. He would go wherever horse and man could go. And Clancy of the Overflow came down to lend a hand. No better horseman ever held the reins, for never horse could throw him while the saddle girths would stand. He learned to ride while droving on the plains. And one was there, a stripling on a small and weedy beast. He was something like a racehorse, undersized, with a touch of team or pony, three parts thoroughbred at least, and such as are by mountain horsemen prized. He was hard and tough and wiry, just the sort that won't say die. There was courage in his quick, impatient tread, and he bore the badge of gameness in his bright and fiery eye and the proud and lofty carriage of his head. But still, so slight and weedy, one would doubt his power to stay. And the old man said, "That horse will never do for a long and tiring gallop. Lad, you'd better stop away. Those hills are far too rough for such as you." So he waited, sad and wistful. Only Clancy stood his friend. "I think we ought to let him come," he said. "I warrant he'll be with us when he's wanted at the end, for both his horse and he are mountain bred. He hails from Snowy River up by Kosciuszko's side, where the hills are twice as steep and twice as rough, where a horse's hoofs strike firelight from the flintstones every stride. The man that holds his own is good enough. And the Snowy River riders on the mountains make their home, where the river runs those giant hills between. I have seen full many horsemen since I first commenced to roam, but nowhere yet such horsemen have I seen." So he went. They found the horses on the big mimosa clump. They raced away towards the mountain's brow, and the old man gave his orders. "Boys, go at them from the jump. No use to try for fancy riding now. And Clancy, you must wheel them. Try and wheel them to the right. Ride boldly, lad, and never fear the spills, for never yet was rider that could keep the mob in sight if once they gained the shelter of those hills." So Clancy rode to wheel them. He was racing on the wing, where the best and boldest riders take their place. And he raced his stock horse past them, and he made the rangers ring with a stock whip as he met them face to face. Then they halted for a moment while he swung the dreaded lash, but they saw their well-loved mountain full in view, and they charged beneath the stock whip with a sharp and sudden dash, and off into the mountain scrub they flew. Then fast the horsemen followed, where the gorges deep and black resounded to the thunder of their tread, and the stock whips woke the echoes, and they fiercely answered back from cliffs and crags that beetled overhead. And upward, ever upward, the wild horses held their way, where mountain ash and carajong grew wide. And the old man muttered fiercely, "We may bid the mob good day. No man can hold them down the other side." When they reached the mountain summit, even Clancy took a pull. It well might make the boldest hold their breath. The wild hop scrub grew thickly, and the hidden ground was full of wombat holes, and any slip was death. But the man from Snowy River let the pony have his head, and he swung his stockwhip round and gave a cheer, and he raced him down the mountains like a torrent down its bed, while the others stood and watched in very fear. He sent the flint stones flying, but the pony kept his feet. He cleared the fallen timber in his stride, and the man from Snowy River never shifted in his seat. It was grand to see that mountain horseman ride. Through the stringy barks and saplings on the rough and broken ground, down the hillside at a racing pace he went, and he never drew the bridle till he landed safe and sound at the bottom of that terrible descent. He was right among the horses as they climbed the farther hill, and the watchers on the mountain, standing mute, saw him ply the stockwhip fiercely. He was right among them still as he raced across the clearing in pursuit. Then they lost him for a moment where two mountain gullies met in the ranges, but a final glimpse reveals on a dim and distant hillside the wild horses racing yet with the man from Snowy River at their heels. And he ran them single-handed till their sides were white with foam. He followed like a bloodhound on their track till they halted, cowed and beaten. Then he turned their heads for home, and alone and unassisted brought them back. But his hardy mountain pony, he could scarcely raise a trot. He was blood from hip to shoulder from the spur, but his pluck was still undaunted and his courage fiery hot, for never yet was mountain horse a cur. And down by Kosciuszko, where the pine-clad ridges raise their torn and rugged battlements on high, where the air is clear as crystal and the white stars fairly blaze at midnight in the cold and frosty sky, and where around the overflow the reed beds sweep and sway to the breezes, and the rolling plains are wide, the man from Snowy River is a household word today, and the stockmen tell the story of his ride. Evesong by Mary Gilmore. I span and Eve span a thread to bind to the heart of man. But the heart of man was a wandering thing that came and went with little to bring. Nothing he minded what we made, as here he loitered and there he stayed. I span and Eve span a thread to bind the heart of man, but the more we span, the more we found it wasn't his heart, but ours we bound, for children gathered about our knees. The thread was a chain that stole our ease. And one of us learned in our children's eyes that more than man was love and prize. But deep in the heart of one of us lay a root of loss and hidden dismay. He said he was strong. He had no strength but that which comes of breadth and length. He said he was fond, but his fondness proved the flame of an hour when he was moved. He said he was true. His truth was but a door that winds could open and shut. And yet, as he came back, wandering in from the outward track, we held our arms and gave him our breast as a pillowing place for his head to rest. I span and Eve span, a thread to bind the heart of man. The Agricultural Show, Flemington, Victoria, by Fernley Maurice. The lumbering tractor rolls its panting round, the windmills fan the blue, feet crush the sand. The pumps spurt muddy water to the sound, the muffled thud and blare of a circus band. For this is the other life I know so little of, a life of fevered effort, of wool and tortured love. Why didn't somebody tell me ere 'twas too late to learn this life, with its fire and vigour, by break and anguish burn, gorgeous and ghastly and rare, flourished out there. But I just sit in a tram and pay my fare, me, an important man in the job I hold. But there are the roots of the hills of gold that my clawed fingers tell. Why didn't somebody say, before I was old, that there were Brumbies to break and there storm mobs to muster when I was bred to the clang of a tram bell, answered an ad, and took up a shopman's duster? Here is a world that stands upon sun and rain and a humid odour of wool where the sheafing grain falls like pay in the palm. I but rode out the calm in a regular job and felt the years fall by to a pension and senile golf. That's the whole tale. But there's another world in the white of a bullock's eye strained as he horns a rail. I, with an unshod outlaw between my knees, dream, but awake to the old, "Fares, please, fares, please," the long, low bellowing of yarded herds, the song of sweating horsemen on the plains, the outlaw's mating scream, drought and the offal birds, yellowing lemons and longed-for rains. That was the dream. Beach Burial by Kenneth Slessor. Softly and humbly to the Gulf of Arabs the convoys of dead sailors come. At night they sway and wander in the waters far under, but morning rolls them in the foam. Between the sob and clubbing of the gunfire, someone, it seems, has time for this, to pluck them from the shallows and bury them in burrows and tread the sand upon their nakedness. And each cross, the driven stake of tidewood, bears the last signature of men, written with such perplexity, with such bewildered pity, the words choke as they begin. Unknown seamen. The ghostly pencil wavers and fades. The purple drips. The breath of the wet season has washed their inscriptions as blue as drowned men's lips. Dead seamen, gone in search of the same landfall, whether as enemies they fought, or fought with us, or neither. The sand joins them together, enlisted on the other front. L. Alamein. Football Field, Evening, by J. A. R. McKellar. Crossbars and posts, the echo of distant bells, the cool and friendly scent of whispering turf, and in the air a little wind that tells of moonlit waves beyond a murmuring surf. The glittering blue and verdant afternoon has locked up all its colours, leaving dearth, deserted. Underneath a careless moon, the glory has departed from this earth. The goals stand up on their appointed lines, but all their worth has faded with the sun. Unchallenged now, I cross their strict confines. The ball is gone, the game is lost and won. I walk again where once I came to grief, crashing to earth, yet holding fast the ball. Symbol of yet another true belief, the last, but surely not the least of all. To strain and struggle to the end of strength, to lean on skill, not ask a gift of chance, to win or lose and recognize at length the game, the thing, the rest, a circumstance. And now the teams are vanished from the field, but still an echo of their presence clings. The moon discovers what the day concealed, the gracefulness and grief of passing things. Quick as the ball is thrown from hand to hand and fleetly as the wing three quarters run, swifter shall time to his defences stand and bring the fastest falling one by one. until the moon that looked on Stonehenge ground before the stones will rise and sink and set above this field, where also will be found the relics of a mystery men forget. The Brown Snake by Douglas Stewart. I walked to the green gum tree because the day was hot. A snake could be anywhere, but that time I forgot. The duck malloy lays through the valley in amber pools like tea from some old fossicker's billy, and I walked under the tree. Blue summer smoked on Bindo. It lapped me warm in its waves. And when that snake hissed up under the shower of leaves, huge, high as my waist, rearing with lightning tongue, so brown with heat like the fallen dry sticks it hid among, I thought the earth itself under the green gum tree, all in the sweet of summer, reached out to strike at me. Prize Giving by Gwen Harwood. Professor Eisenbart, asked to attend a girls' school speech night as an honoured guest and give the prizes out, rudely declined. But from indifference agreed, when pressed with dry scholastic jokes, to change his mind, to grace their humble platform, and to lend distinction of a kind not specified to the occasion. Academic dress became him, as he knew. When he appeared, the girls whirred with an insect nervousness. The head, in humbler black, flapped round and steered her guest, superb in silk and fur, with pride to the best seat beneath half-hearted blooms tortured to form the school's elaborate crest. Eisenbart scowled with violent distaste, then recomposed his features to their best advantage, deep in thought, with one hand placed like Rodin's sinker. So he watched the room's mosaic of young heads, blonde, black, mouse brown, they bent for their headmistress's opening prayer. But underneath a light, no accident of seating, he felt sure, with Titian hair, one girl sat grinning at him, her hand bent under her chin in mockery of his own. Speeches were made and prizes given. He shook indifferently a host of virgin hands. Music! The girl with Titian hair stood up, hitched at a stocking, winked at nearby friends, and stood before him to receive a cup of silver chased with curious harps. He took her hand and felt its voltage fling his hold from his calm age and power. Suffered her strange eyes, against reason dark, to take his stare with her to the piano, there to change her casual schoolgirls for a master's air. He forged his rose-hot dream as Mozart told the fullness of all passion or despair summoned by arrogant hands. The music ended. Eisenbart teased his gown while others clapped, and peered into a trophy which suspended his image upside down, a sage fool trapped by music in a copper net of hair. Jack by Rosemary Dobson. My mortal husk is shelled at death and shut inside a narrow box, but he is coffined up in life. Oh, what a bitter paradox. He crouches low and supplicant, his elbows knocking on the wood, and with a cry too thin to hear, implores the gods that somehow good will bring him to a just release. He waits the tapping at the locks, and hears the children calling, Jack! They think he sleeps inside his box. They think he sleeps. But how he weeps, his small tears falling with no sound like ghostly leaves that seem to fall and fade upon a haunted ground. We touched the lock, and up he sprang, delight upon his simple face, as though he knew himself at last, the poet-prophet of his race. All lowly jacks shut up in boxes, composed of odds and ends of wood, who have such brief, amended chances to see the world and find it good. The children laughed and stretched their hands and called again, "For Jack, for Jack!" But with a sudden brutal thrust, I caught his head and pushed him back, thinking, it does not do to muse and give to toys of stick and straw emotions that belong to life, lest the conclusions that we draw might yet be turned upon ourselves to show each in his narrow place of flesh and blood, like jacks of straw, shut down and crying for release. The Bus Ride Home by Nan MacDonald. A bus will be provided for the mourners. That's common form at funerals down our way, but we would think it odd if someone said, a bus will be provided for the dead. And yet I almost thought the other day, no, it was just a normal bus ride home, or so it seemed at first. I always say it's soothing to sit there, the day's work done, although you bump and rattle in your seat, and watch blue dusk roll inland from the sea, the darkening range loom up beyond the town, the yellow lamps thin out along the street, while scraps of talk float around you on a haze of smoke and beer. So, listening drowsily, I heard a voice, "And how's old Jack these days?" And the answer came, "Oh, Jack? He's down 6 feet." Grinding our gears, we lurched and swung to take the mountain road. "Buried last Tuesday week," was the next I heard, and then the first man said, "Ah, oh, well, he was brought up to it." And that, it seemed, was that. They spoke of other things, but I sat still while through my empty head the question echoed, startling me awake. Brought up to it? Brought up to being dead? I remember then, of course, these were old miners. The words that fell with such a tolling sound, no doubt, were ancient stuff to them. Half joke, half pride of trade. What's 6 feet to a miner? Let others shrink from being laid underground. Old Jack would fear no more the fall of the rock, the water flooding in, the living tomb past help, the loaded air that waits the spark, the creeping afterdamp. Those shapes of doom known all his years would never break his sleep or rise to haunt him, only 6 feet deep. Yet my first thought would not be brushed away. If that were true of him, true of us all. The girl beside me held a bunch of jonquils. I had to turn my head, their scent had grown so sickly sweet, so heavy. My hand lay across my bag. I saw how white the bone shone through the skin, and round us the weak light gave way before a stealthy tide of darkness that scoured the hollows out in face and throat and filled the sockets of the eyes with shade. A cold breath drifted inward from the night, and someone shut the glass, as if in fear our flesh would crumble at its touch to dust. The lamps had dropped behind us now and gone. The trees, like black plumes, dipped above the road. I thought of crying, "Stop, I'll get off here." Too late, I knew. So the bus laboured on up the dark mountain with its mortal load brought up to death, in training for the grave. That was the strangest ride I've had this year. The Way to the Headland by Jill Hellier. When the stranger asked how far, I did not know. The first time it had seemed so short a way, straight from the humpback scrubland, while the day closed like a bud around us. I remembered the glow of dusk on yellow earth and how the sea seemed strangely near as it curled about the reef, and how solemn had been that moment of belief that we were sharing this affinity. Yet the way had been so long the second time, stumbling alone and breathless. I remembered the barren sky, the headlands sparsely timbered, and facing the bleak harbour after the climb, how I had leaned to watch the waves torment the crumbling rocks, and how the cliffs plunged down and down to soundless currents, where to drown may or may not have been an accident. Not so on known tracks where the image stuns, not in neat gardens spilling Latin names, where stark japonicas emerge as flames and wattles droop their melting yellow suns. How far from one transience of understanding to another shed on the wind-frozen edge of life. We had touched out on that sandstone ledge, the pulse beat of the infinite, demanding nothing of one another. Yet, despite that, or because of it, on separate paths we left. You as a man, strong. I as a woman, bereft. With the long night stretched before me, dark and flat. I could not tell how long it took to reach the headland, if it could be reached again, or was a fantasy that might remain as so many bones for truth to strip and bleach. I was as much a stranger there as he, and only knew the near familiar things, japonicas that opened petalled wings and the melting suns upon the wattle tree, sharp, rich and vivid things, the grass, fresh mown, white apple blossoming and the summer scent. But all of it, one dark imprisonment at every place where I must walk alone. If you should come to me, if we went back and found the measure of each other's minds, I'd tell the stranger then how far it winds, and with new courage turn to face the track. So that's it for this week's Touchstone. Thank you for coming to my place. Until next week, this is CJ signing off. Bye.